I'm going to entitle this testimony, The Relationship Between Parent and Child, a Testimony by the Pastor. If this testimony doesn't apply to you and you're not too interested in it, why, you just feel free to slip out quietly, I'll understand. I want to talk to your parents and to your children about the relationships. Pardon me. And I'm hoping that some of the experiences will prompt, will put some light on in your minds and will help you. You know, so many times we had a child in this assembly that was devastated practically by sweetheart, well-meaning parents. They wanted everything to be done for Jesus, so he got saved, and now the whole family was in, and now we're going to walk with Jesus. And so with this, you know, not knowing how to do it, knew, you know, in the lack of wisdom, but just everything 100% type. And all of a sudden, new rules for all the kids, and, you know, they don't know much about that. And all of a sudden, every single thing was, well, now Jesus wouldn't want you to do that. Well, Jesus said this, and Jesus, and this thing, you know, that child feels like, boy, this Jesus person, whoever that is really a roughie. I can't please Jesus no matter what I do. See? And they don't have a concept like we do about Jesus or about God. And pretty soon, they're hearing a Sunday school class about Jesus, but from the parents, they're constantly hearing, this Jesus is never satisfied with me. And you know what they can do to a child? See, just not knowing, they practically devastated the child. And so I'm hoping it will be a benefit. Well, my story starts about the second time I fell in love. The first time I fell in love was with my wife. And the second time was my baby girl. And I fell in love with her as soon as I saw her in the hospital. And I really had a big case. And you know, and this, I really fell in love with that girl. I don't think a father ever loved his daughter more than I have. I really mean that. And some people out there challenged me already. And that's good. But I took her just a few days old to church, showed her off to the pastor. He said she was the prettiest girl in the church, and I agreed. And to everybody around, I was so proud of that girl. And, you know, all the time, in the hospital, she was scratching her, we could see that she had scratches on her face. And I thought, why don't they take care of those fingernails, you know? And as soon as I get her home, and as soon as I got her home, my wife said, my wife was a super mother, but she said she was almost afraid to do anything with little tiny nails, you know? And I didn't feel that way. I thought, this is no problem. It's just a technical matter of getting right on there and, you know, getting them right in position and clicking them. And so I got her right there and got those nails off. And my heart was locked into that girl. And I taught her at, you know, every opportunity. And as she got a little older, could toddle. And I'd come home from work on the bus, and I was about 2.5 blocks away from home, the bus line. My wife would bring her out and stand on the street, on the sidewalk, before we got to the end of the block, and just wait for Daddy. And when I crossed the street so it was safe, she'd turn her loose, and she would go toddling down the walk at me. I'd fly into my arms, and from then on, we dated the rest of the night. You know, we did things together. I loved that thing. We taught her diligently the words of life. Well, my daughter never had to grow up like some daughters, many daughters I've heard saying, well, I never really knew my dad. Well, my dad and I never were close. We never really had a good relationship. That is so sad. That is so sad. You know, you can't afford to be too busy to know your children. And dad's, it's not the mother's kid. You know, she's yours. She's yours. And I took time for my daughter. We were constantly, you know, I was so proud of her. She could say the alphabet at 2 years old. And she forgot it at 3, and I had to reteach it at 3.5 before she even knew what it was, you know. But we were constantly pouring information to her. And we had a good relationship. See, we had a solid love relationship built. so against anything in the future, since you wouldn't have this insecurity, this other thing, because of that. Well, there came a day, and with all my children, I feel, you know, and parents tend to forget as time goes on. You forget, you know, all you, you forget the spankings or the problems, and all you can remember is you love them and you're proud of them. And I may, you know, forget some things along the line here. And if my wife has anything to add afterwards, well, she can. But we had a confrontation with each child. Somewhere in their life, there was a confrontation. Although our kids were so easy to bring up. I mean, we had good kids. We stayed at one place. Well, the neighbor kid, he was always had a problem. And the mother would say to my wife across the fence, "You are so lucky that, you know, to have gotten good kids." And I said to my wife, "Isn't it strange that those who believe in discipline accidentally get the good ones, you know?" But you see, we never had to spank our children much because we didn't let them go. We gave them lots of love so they weren't having reactions because of lack of love. That's what a lot of it is. And wanting attention. We gave them the attention. And then secondly, we didn't permit any rebellion. We permitted no confrontation with us. If we said this, then that's the way it is. And just like Mama Bear does with Baby Bear, she is right on their discipline, and they follow exactly what Mother says. And so our children are happier that way, and they're free. We didn't have to give them any spankings. But now, there came a time with a confrontation with Carolyn at 3 years old. Is that right? About 2.5 years old. And she had a heart to please. That girl, you know, she was always wanting to please. She was never an independent type. She was passive. And she saw the light in our hearts when, you know, when she'd do things we liked, and she would just wanted more of that, and she just lived for us. It seemed like this so easy, except for one other area that I'll mention. And but it came a time, 2.5 years old, that her will had to be confronted. She had to make a decision all of a sudden. And I think a demon, I did not know that at the time, and I don't know it now, but I think that a demon probably at that time came into her mind, because he hated that sweet, constant submissiveness. Now, for you that came in on Johnny Come Late's on this deliverance, I'm not talking about demon possession. I'm going to wrap what I'm going to say up now in a very small, little tiny handful of information by saying this. This idea that I was brought up with, and a lot of you were brought up with, and many are dogmatic about but got zero proof, that the Bible does not really make a distinction between demon possession and demon oppression. This idea that, well, that's not demon possessed, but this is oppressed, we use all the time. The Bible doesn't even say that. It does not say that. You cannot find that in the Scriptures. And what God revealed to me, and I finally learned, was that all demons tempt from within. They don't tempt from out here. There is no proof that demons tempt from outside your head. None. All temptation is coming into the mind, and there is no proof that it happens outside. But there is proof that it happens inside. And demons in Christians of cancer, they're inside. Doesn't mean your spirit is possessed in a way that it's being owned by them. They want to use all these scriptures like, well, you know, we are temples of the Holy Ghost. Well, that doesn't mean anything. As far as an argument goes, how about Peter? Jesus said, "Get behind me, Satan." When he spoke, Satan spoke out of his mouth. You can't get away from it. These demons lodge in the mind or in the body. I'm not talking about the spirit, in the mind or the body, and they tempt from within. They always tempt. Melancholy. Fears. They storm the brain from within, and they can speak out through the brain by giving it information. That's why we have found little children affected, and people, Christians, good Christians, even pastors, demons speaking out of their mouth, saying what their name is and how they came in and what they did, and even when they were tiny children. See, would he do that? Every person is tempted of the devil Every person is tempted of the devil. Even Jesus Christ was tempted of the devil. And he tempts from within. That takes away all the worry about, oh, you believe demons are in Christians? He can't tempt you unless he is. He doesn't tempt from out there. He uses the brain. He's in here. He's working. And there have been many who have seen by the Spirit demons in the mind and so forth, and then feel them leave and so forth. Well, anyway, that's just no extra charge for that. I believe the Spirit began to contest to at that moment because he saw something wonderful and precious. And now the whole thing dependent upon what happened in this confrontation, whether he would stay or whether he wouldn't stay. And there's been so many children that from the adults, that from the time they were little, something entered and stayed because it wasn't taken care of properly. And it was a small issue. And she'd always been super pleasing. And I just asked her something I've asked her lots of times. Please pick up your blocks. She always did it immediately. Went right over and did it. Never said a word. She never said, oh, Daddy. She said, well, just did it. She was that way. And all of a sudden, no. I said, Carolyn, pick your blocks up. No. Something happened. There wasn't any good reason. She wasn't sick. I said, you pick those blocks up. No. I believe there's a spirit in there. And I spanked her. Pick them up. Spank, spank, spank. No. Didn't cry even. And she would always cry if you spanked her. And I spanked her a number of times. I didn't want to spank her anymore. I didn't want to hurt her, you know. But I knew I didn't dare let her go. And so I got a newspaper and I rolled it up. And never hit him with a tight end, always the loose end at the back. And what I decided I had to do, I tried to make it as traumatic, loud, boisterous, fearful as possible without hurting. So I used the newspaper for the loudness, and yet the soft end of a newspaper wouldn't hurt her any. And every time she said no, I turned up the heat. And I kept turning the heat up and turning the heat up. And pretty soon, inside I was wondering, what else can I do, you know? And so, you know, I turned her upside down, held her by the ankle. I mean, and I was, my volume had come up, and I'd wham, you mind me. I am the boss. You have got to mind. And I was pulling this information into her head, and wham, wham, wham. No, see, no crying. And I swollen the, you know, and I hauled her through the air. I took her. What I did is I took her, and I told my wife as I passed. My wife just kept back and let me take care of it. It was the way to do it. And I told her as I passed, I said, if she wins this round, we're in trouble. And I whisked her in the bedroom, and I took her through the air like the flying trapeze, you know, like Superman. I went, you know. I threw her on the bed so she'd bounce. I did everything to make it as traumatic as possible to bring, you know, to break her will. And I was going at it, heard a knock at the door, and it was my brother and his wife. And I said, oh, no. They'll think I'm in here fighting with my wife, saying, I am the boss, you mind me, you know. And, you know, and I was... And so, anyway, let him in, and I don't remember how the thing went exactly, but... Finally, she came to the end of the endurance. And somehow, at the point, she was willing. She went, picked him up. And we put her pajamas on for bed. And I may not have, you know, my wife remembers things in more detail. And sometimes I forget some of the details. But this is how I remember the story. It's been a long time ago. More than five. And we put pajamas on, and she came up on my lap, and she sat down, and she looked me in the face. See, the thing is, we had been lovers, her and I. We had such a wonderful relationship. She loved me, and I loved her. And here we were going through this confrontation. And it was nothing really ugly. It was just loud from my end, and it was just stubborn from hers. And she came up and looked me in the face and says, Daddy, I'm sorry. You see, her soul, I am sure that was a demon now. And she didn't know what happened. She didn't know what was happening to her. She was just letting that thing speak out. She just felt emotional this way. She didn't know why. She was sorry. She would never have done that. And I hugged him and I kissed him. We always, my children always could call him on our lap if we ever spanked him and get loved. And we took a picture of her right after that, and her face glowed like an angel. She's still sitting there in her pajamas in this little chair, beaming after the wildest spanking that anybody ever got in their entire life, practically. And we don't tell people when we show it to them. This was after the great tribulation. She's beaming like an angel. That spirit left. And she's just so happy to have it gone. Now see, that solves something. Now some of you parents, you see, every one of you are going to have to make a confrontation with your children. And some of you will make a horrible mistake. And the longer you let it go, the more difficult it is to correct. And let me give you a hint right here. Let me give you a big hint. When you go into parenting class, like my wife teaches, and you get all this neat stuff, and you can go home and try it out, you know why? It just doesn't immediately work. Because they've had years of wrong practice and teaching, and all of a sudden they haven't read the book. They didn't take notes. And so you try on this new thing, they don't just flip right over. It's going to take patience, continuance to retrain and reteach to get into a whole new framework. And it takes patience, but you can get them now. And so, some of you, that you know, the child is in a supermarket, see, and he wants a popsicle. You say, no, and, no, and, no, you can't have one. Goes the air raid siren again, and pretty soon, no, and pretty soon, well, okay, no. But after dinner, she first step in. No. Okay. But just one, see. And you start giving in because you don't want the confrontation. And they get stubborn. And they can get stubborn. The old Adamic man plus demon spirit, you know, plus immaturity and whatever, can get stubborn. And so you back off and they win. And that spirit stays and it's reinforced. And every time they do it, it gets more difficult. And more difficult and more difficult to turn around. And pretty soon, they got you on the ropes, and then we both know who's boss, them. And then they get all kinds of confrontations, they get problems, you know. But you see, you need to take care of it immediately. And that's what causes these other things. I mentioned this a long time ago, if you don't mind, I'll mention it again. I got on a bus one time, and this kid, you know, mother was waiting for the bus, this kid about 4 years old, I suppose. And so finally, the bus stopped, and the kid wouldn't get on. And with much effort, she finally got him on the bus. And then he wanted to put the money in. And so finally, she gave him the coin, and then he was all over the place instead of putting it in where it goes. She finally got the coin in, and then she couldn't get him to sit where she wanted. He wanted to sit someplace else. She finally got him crawl over against the window. And he reaches over, and he pulls the window down. And she shoves it up. He pulls it down. She shoves it up, and he pulls it down. She shoves him up. And he's sitting right in front of me. I almost put a Hata Kajume on him, a Japanese stranglehold from right behind, you know. Laid him out, you know. But I forbade. And, you know, see, my dad would never let me get away with that. And we would never let our kids get away with that. I mean, we did not allow any no back to us. We would never tolerate a willing disobedience. And time of growing up, they may have, but I don't remember any case where, you know, they willingly disobeyed, knowingly, but that has passed the little tiny ages, you know. Well, anyway, then that matter was settled and it was smooth sailing from then on. No problem then on. So that's the first thing is the wheel has got to be brought into a place of subjection. And you've got to win the round. You've got to win it. Now, if you haven't done it right, now you've got a real difficult thing. And you just can't beat them to death. All of a sudden, you know, after, you know, years, you're going to have to do patient work. It's going to take the wisdom of Solomon plus to get it turned around. But eventually, you must get it turned around. You're going to have a problem on your hands. Now, children are always different, all different. All of our kids were different. Everyone was different. Like children, and I mentioned some of these things before, but I'll use them as basis of my statements. Killen, for example, she would come up, and she was very passive in nature, and she'd come up and say, "Mommy, do you think I'm hungry?" when she wanted a cookie. Because she wanted to please, and she did not want any confrontation. Say, "I want a cookie," and she did not want to hear a no. Therefore, she would ask, and she avoided the no. Now, Daniel, my oldest boy, was a sweetheart of a boy. And he was rather passive, too. And he would say, but a little more boy-like, so a little bit more direct, he would say, Mama, I want a cookie. He would say what he wanted, but he wouldn't go get it. Because he was not the type that could face the confrontation of a, no, you can't have it, you keep, you know, and spank or get out of it, whatever. So he would ask permission. David would slide the chair over, climb on it, open the lid, reach his hand down, and get one. Because David wasn't afraid of the confrontation when it came. And the kids have remained that way throughout their life. And that's the truth. Daniel, even when he grew up, he would never argue back. Or anybody. If he didn't like the heat, he'd just move off. And when they were little, Carolyn and Daniel would play. And she being quite a bit older, and having to watch the kids a lot at all with delegated authority and all of this, and she had, because she was older, so she'd play, you know, and okay, and so she'd, you know, mother hen and mother Daniel. Well, he didn't know, you know, he couldn't play the game at his age, the same as her. She had all these things, and we were doing this, and I'm the mom, and you're the daddy, we're going to do this, now you do this, and okay, you go over there, and you do this, and he thought it was fun for a while, but he didn't have the attention span. He couldn't get into it like her mind could, and so he'd go around, you know, but after a while, he'd had enough of it with her, you know, mother-handing him all the time, and so finally, she'd do this, and he'd just walk off down the hall, and he'd just head off over the horizon. And that was it. And then Daniel, it never make any difference there. That was it, see. He'd never resist. He'd just move on away. And that's the way he's always been. He's still that way. Now, David would stand there, and he would take the confrontation. He'd make something out of it and tell, you know, one of you won or something. And I looked at the window one day, and there was David, who was younger than Daniel. And Daniel was there, and this bully was trying to get tough with Daniel. And David was younger, and he saw it, and he was just toddling. And he reached over and found himself a good long little switch, and he came toddling over. He was going to take care of that big kid for Daniel. See, he had the guts. Now, I'll tell you a wonderful thing about that. The wonderful thing about that is... See, the bad thing first is that, see, David has a Friedreich's ataxia, which started to affect him at about 5 or 6 years old. And it's been a progressive neurological, muscular thing. And the specialist told us, when children get this kind of a thing, they do one of two things, depending on the personality. They either turn the face to the wall, like Hezekiah, and give up. So he didn't use the word Hezekiah. And give up. They cannot face what's happened to them. Down, 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 down. They cannot face it. And so they turn their face to the wall and give up and go into deep melancholy and retreat inside, and nobody can reach them. And they're just a silent hulk of nothing. Or else, they don't like what happens and they fight it. And they can't fight the physical, but they do everything possible to get to overcome it. And that's what David's done. And you see, if he had a different soul, if this had happened to Daniel, he could have been in deep trouble. But with David, he had the guts to fight it. And David never wanted anybody to ever feel sorry for him. He won the year of the award. I mean, the camp boy of the award when you're up there at Bible camp. He struck out about 75 times. At that time, he couldn't hit the ball because this thing, he couldn't, his muscles weren't working right from the lower brain, and he kept missing, but he was always there. He wasn't blubbering about it. He was, you know, he had, and the camp counselor was amazed at this kid who couldn't keep up, but he had the guts. They gave him camp award, camp boy of the war, boy of camp, or whatever it is, word camp of the boy or something. And anyway, I feel that God, I feel that this disease that God has allowed to fasten on him, because you know, the devil can't do it without God allowing. I believe that it may have been for the very best. You see, eternity is a long time. And this life is but a handbreadth, the scripture says. This, David's reaction to this has made him into a champion, young fellow. He's never complained. I am so proud of that boy. He has never complained. He is always blessing others. He's always trying to help others. He spent so much time even volunteering one finger typing for somebody else when he could hardly find the keys. And calling him up and other people running around, and he, you know, confined, you know, many, many times. I hear him on the phone trying to comfort, you know, and give him the scriptures and all this and helping. And this happened because he had this kind, you see, of a soul. And God has allowed that. And because of it, he has become something that he probably would never have been if he had two legs that could run around and play basketball and do everything else. Now, see, he'd love to be able to get a car, get a job, go drive out and pick up a girl, have money to spend on her, open the door for her, have her get in, go out someplace, and go out and do sports. But see, he can't do that. Do you know the guts he's had? Intestinal fortitude? He calls girls out for a date. Somebody's got to lug them on their back. You know what it's like to ask a girl to go when you're going to be lugged around? And he's got to a time, place where he can hardly find his mouth with a spoon. And he sits there with a great big bib where nobody else has this. You see what I'm saying? There's some metal in there that's been built. And you know, his life has not been an easy one. Every year he was downhill and he's had to face things he could not do the year before. Year after year after year. And he has not wavered. God's going to heal me. I am preparing for the ministry. He'll take his Hebrew book to bed with him and study it. And he lives in that stuff all the time. He is preparing for a ministry. Though he God slay him, yet will he trust him. He's like the three Hebrew children that says, God is able to deliver me, but if not, I still won't bow and I won't burn. You know, I mean, I won't bow. And you see, something's happened. He is going to be a higher Chiliarch position in heaven than he would be probably if he didn't have this, because he's had to face cross after cross difficulties, and he's done it admirably. And you see, what I'm trying to say is this: hardly a family goes by but what you put the shovel in of inquiry, and you find out that they've got deep problems in that family. Somebody's got polio. There's a marriage, deep marriage problem. There was some great major problem in almost every family, some way. And you can blame God. You know, you can blame God. What would you do if after blaming God for years, you finally made heaven in a low position, and God showed you what you could have been if you'd not blamed him, showed you why he did it, showed you what how much better off, and that if you didn't, he didn't allow the calamity, and maybe by foreknowledge he knew you would go in the lake of fire. That you would backslide, that something would come your way and you wouldn't make it. And he did you a favor by allowing this to come on your life and allow you to build to something. So this is why we cannot prevail upon the wisdom of God. This is why we've got to say, Lord, I don't understand it, but I'm not going to presume against your great wisdom. You have allowed it, and if you allow it, then I will not countervail. If it's something that the devil has brought, we may rebuke that thing and come against it. But even if God never delivers, even if like Saul, who three times besought the Lord that the thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan, would be taken from him, God said, my strength is sufficient for thee. I don't want to take it away. Pardon me. I don't want to take it away. And if he doesn't, and the person dies, it doesn't mean he's been some fanatic. It may mean that he's got a crown and glory higher than it ever would have been. And God may have allowed it all the way to the end because this one could build metal to the end. Somebody else may give up. He may come along and heal them because they couldn't stand it. Can you not allow it to come upon you more than you're able to bear? This one's tough. He can bear it. And I'm going to give him something on the other side for this. I'm going to let him go all the way down. I'm going to have to heal you at a certain time, or you're going to give up, or you won't make it. Some people be filled with the Holy Ghost fast, and when they're sloppy, only because they're not going to get anything if they don't. So we have to understand that God is God, and His ways are not our ways, and our ways are not His ways. And this idea of trying to put God down into our minds, and us puny people down here trying to, you know, complain, be content with whatever lot you find yourself in, the Scripture says. In other words, if you can't change it, accept it. And if you're going to be miserable or happy, you might as well be happy in it than miserable. And a lot of people going around in the misery, misery, miserable. If you're a young lady and you haven't got a found a husband, and you can get yourself all deeply torn up with demons because you've been 9-10 years looking for a husband. I feel for my daughters. If I could spank my sons into marriage, I'd do it. But in the meantime, there's more ladies than men here. I love my sons here. But in the meantime, you might as well take the time to be close to the Lord. As Paul said, those that, you know, that are married, you know, mind the things of the house and the family and so forth, but those that are single, the things of the Lord. You might as well have a love relationship and build something so that when you get married, you're such a sweetheart that you can get the best and you're ready to go and you can have something that will really work. In the meantime, you've got a love relationship with the Lord. You might as well be happier than miserable. And that's true with every single thing in life. Now, Carolyn was the only thing hard about bringing her up, and she sailed through teenage so easy. You know, a lot of, especially girls, say, oh, girls through teenage, hey, you know what you're going to get into, you know, girls through teenage, ooh, you know. She skipped those phases. A lot of girls go through out there, it seems like. And she skipped the phases of, thinking they're smarter than you and all this silly boy, stuff and silly stuff. That girl's got more wisdom in her head. And she grew up with a lot of, she always had more wisdom for her age than the kids about her because she had a constant teaching. We were not relying on the church to do her teaching for her and the Sunday school. We taught her as though she had no church and Sunday school. We were still teaching and putting into her mind and so forth and helping her along the way in her thinking processes. And she sailed through that and never went through a lot of those phases. She never went through the silly stage and so forth. And now, we had confrontations. I had a confrontation with her when she was a teenage, and I think it's my fault, largely, and I hereby apologize to my daughter. But you know, I was a little bit too bullheaded, a little bit too set, you know. But, see, I didn't know, you know, what an 11-year-old girl feels like inside. I didn't know, you know, the importance. There's a lot of things we don't know as parents, you know. If we could start all over again, we would make an entirely different set of mistakes. You know what I mean? There's a lot of things you don't know when you go through life. And she had this long, beautiful hair. We were so proud. My wife was always taking care of it and always, you know, she's always dressed up, always nice, all the time. And she wanted all the kids at school, you know, they had this stuff sawed off to the shoulders. And I never liked that look. I always thought the down the back was so beautiful. And she wanted this haircut because peer pressure, you know, junior high school, everybody else is doing it. I mean, she didn't want to look like something out of the Victorian age. She wanted to look like everybody else. be normal. And but I couldn't see that. And it was no big deal. It was no big deal outwardly, because she wasn't the type. Now, had been David, we would have had a wrestling match. It would have lasted as long as a millennium. But with her, you know, she acquiesced, but inside she was hurt. It was an important area, and Dad won, and Dad shouldn't have won that. I thought it was important to me that she looked really nice, and I didn't consider the other really nice. But it wasn't hippie. It wasn't worldly. There was nothing wrong with it. I should have had enough intelligence, and I didn't, to think, now this really means a lot to her, and really it means more to her than it does me, and really I should give it to her, and I really should let her do that. And it hurt her. It really hurt her inside that, you know, we had a love relationship going, and I hurt her. I hurt her badly over this. This was an important area. Now, I'm not saying you should let your kid do anything that's worldly, give a bad name, a bad testimony, but that which is neutral. There are parents out here that are too hard on their kids in this area. They are too restrictive. They tell them, no, you don't wear that dress, you wear this, and you do this. Not allowing them to be a normal teenager. Not allowing them in junior high school to pick the dress they're going to put on and do this and pick some clothes out, but managing, controlling them. But you know, you get to a certain age, you really need. I mean, if you're really strict, you can win all the way through prison camp to the end, but you're going to pay for it at the end too. See, you can control them like the Gestapo, but they really need that freedom to begin to learn to make choices and even make mistakes. And have the things that they want and the things that they like. And, you know, we weren't rigid in a lot of other areas. I mean, Carolyn, you know, she always had trouble knowing. She always had to have mother along to find out, even after she got married, you know, for a while. She always had to have mother as, you know, what do you think? Should buy this? She never could make up her mind, you know, should this or should I buy this, you know. She never had this dogmatic opinion. That's one reason she fell in love with Lanny. A few guys dated her, and she was a pastor's daughter. And, boy, I mean, they were playing with hot coals, you know. And she wasn't satisfied. She said, you know, Daddy, I can wrap him around my little finger. She didn't want that, you know. I mean, they all backed off and bowing and scraping to her, see? She didn't want that. And here come Lanny, you know, he's a certain character. You have to understand Lanny to know this. But he comes in, you know, and, you know, where angels fear to tread. And he just, you know, and she loved it. She loved the fact that he would be the man. And Lanny had his dogmatic opinions and his ideas and how he was going to do things and so forth, and he wasn't about saying it, and she needed that for her life. And some of your husbands have taken your club back at the back of the bus, you know, and your wife's driving. And you need to, you know, get up to the front of the bus and get on the seat, you know, and put it beside you. You haven't taken your position in the family, as the head of the family, and you need to do that. I had a confrontation with my boy Daniel. He was an easy boy to raise. My kids were all good kids. Carolyn was fussy when she was little. She was all the reasons why she should be insecure or whatever, but I would work night for a year when I was young on a green chain, and it came time for her to go to bed, like the kids do in the middle of the day and all this, and I just had to sleep in the middle of the day. My wife would take her, and because of a situation, it was so much easier to throw in bed with Daddy. Because she was in bed with Daddy, she'd go to sleep. And that girl had a hard time going to sleep. That was the one big problem with Carolyn. She never wanted to go to sleep. And she vowed later that she was never going to have a bed in her house. Well, she's given in. She's got a bed now. But she had but she's still like that. She's, you know, she believes that late to bed and late to rise makes a person healthy and wise, you know. And fortunately, she married a husband the same way. And so she never, you know, she never could go to bed. She denied she was sleeping until she conked out, you know. And when my two boys were down at the Bon Marché or Fayette Nelson, whatever it was one day, and you know, Christmas rush and all the crowds of people up and down the big aisles, and looked over, and there David was, or whoever it was, right fast asleep in the middle of the main aisle, relaxed as could be, cool as a cucumber, you know. And one night we were showing films, and took his shoes off and says, night, night. You know, I mean, they could go to sleep just like that. They never will problem that way. They gave the baby bottle up at 8 months, you know, and they were this type of thing, you know. And her, I was so embarrassed. She'd be running out in the yard. I said, "Honey, we've got to take that bottle away from her before, you know, she grows up, goes in college with it. She'd have chocolate milk in it, and it'd be hanging, like swinging, you know." And she'd be telling me. We tried everything to get that thing away. We would throw it away at grandma's. My wife would sneak it back in the purse, so we would leave, you know, and then she'd be willing to throw it away, but then on the way home, "I want my bottle," you know? And there we were going. We finally got, when my wife offered her a Joseph book or the bottle, and she took the Joseph book. And then later, "I want my bottle," when night came again. And we finally got it away from her, and she fussed for a month, and we didn't know what the reason was, because she made no deal of it for a while, never asked for it again. And finally, my brother was living with us, Joe, and he's going to the University of Washington. I said, "I wonder if that's because of that bottle, you know." He says, "Give it to her." We gave it back, she snapped right out of it. In a short time, why, of course, she gave it up. But see, each child is different. Each one is different. I used to dangle her outside. My father had a Lutheran church that he had bought, and he was preaching in. I'd out there in the foyer, you know, and I'd play with the bell rope and peeking through the tunnel, listening to my father preach, and, you know, like this. She was hard to get to sleep. The boy's never a problem that way. See, each one is a different soul. And you can't get so rigid to treat them all like peas in a pod, you know. You have to, you know, tailor make. You don't go down to the store, we got the kids different sizes, and say, you know, "Give me three number 11 sizes." You get a size for each one. You have to do everything according to the child, because they are different. And it isn't just like, "I got some notes from family relations and I'm going to take this thing and gun each one with the same one." You've got to deal with each one individually, like God does with us. And but anyway, I had a confrontation. Otherwise, she was simple to raise with Daniel in teenage. And the problem came because I entered the ministry. And we took our kids lots of places. I played with my kids' fathers. I played with them. I swung them and wrestled with them. And all my kids have got big tablets of all the pictures that each little pictures they drew. And I'd sit down with them. And I'd have them go step by step how to draw a man swimming in the water with his mouth open, his head half in the water, and step by step, and elephants and all kinds of things. And we drew, and I made games and played with them. And I did everything from, you know, swings and wrestling and everything there was with them. We took them places. We had good relationships with our children. But I hit the ministry, and I was working 40 hours a week. I was with a Boeing company that transferred me up to Everett. I was driving 100 miles a day, and I had a new congregation that were hungry for the word. And we had three services on Sundays, like we do now, what I call three services, and three preaching sessions. And Friday night, we had a Bible study, and then I had something, and we had a prayer meeting during the week, and there was one more thing, I can't remember what it was. And I was going around the clock, studying all the time. And Carolyn was old enough that it didn't really affect her. And David was young enough, it didn't really affect him. He had his friends, and he'd bring them in, and we had a little milkshake bar or something. He'd make this milkshake and this tulips all on the Sundays and everything, and he was around with them. But Daniel was caught in the crunch. And I didn't know it, because he didn't know how to tell me, and I didn't realize. And all of a sudden, he was doing some dumb things. And I didn't relate him, and I didn't know why he was doing these dumb things. And pretty soon my wife came one day and she said, "Honey, you're picking on Daniel." And a light came in. You know, I didn't recognize I was picking on him. All I was doing was trying to tell him not to do those dumb things. And so I said, "Well, all I'm doing is he's doing all these dumb things all the time. So every time he does a dumb thing, I say, 'Daniel, don't do that dumb thing.'" See? And she said, "Well, you're going to lose him if you're going to keep on." And that's all she said. And I thought about it. And I decided she was right. Now, see, we didn't go into a nine-hour argument, a marriage fight over it. See? She knew enough just to say that and walk off and let me think about it. Because if she threw something up, my mind would say, "Well, no, you know, I might be defensive, you know, no, defensive." She walked off and left it. And so next time he come cruising by, "How you doing, pal?" And I started calling him pal all the time. I started reaching out. you know. And I didn't realize what he was doing. And he needed his dad. And I was swamped and wasn't giving him the time at that particular time. And I didn't realize, you know, he's, you know, he had kids out of school. I mean, you know, why does he need his dad? I mean, you know, he's in junior high school. He's going to be getting along fine. As far as we know, on the surface, everything looked good. I didn't know, you know, I didn't see that, you know, he, you know, wasn't, you know, needed to hug him or anything. I mean, what's, you know, what was this, you know, what does he need? It wasn't evident to my mind at the time. But he saw he had a relationship with me that all of a sudden he didn't have. Not that we tried to, you know, to boycott him, but all of a sudden I was swamped in the ministry and I just gave everything to the ministry. Now, a lot of you have done this. You have just thrown yourself so much in the ministry that where's your kid? For Jesus, you've lost your kid. And all of a sudden he feels it, and all of a sudden he's cantankerous, he's ornery, you don't know why he's doing what he's doing. Because kids don't come out, you know, if he would only come out and say, Dad, I'm hurting, I need you, I am insecure. But they never tell you that. They get in trouble instead. And our kids didn't have an opportunity to go to the Christian schools, didn't have Christian schools, so we went to public school. And Daniel was pounding on a couple of kids, and they weren't real bad kids, but they were kids of the world, you know. And all of a sudden, one day we're going to church, and I get some rebellious thing from him in the back seat. And I had one foot in the accelerator, and I was practically beating him to death in the back seat. That kind of a statement. And he didn't make those kind of statements. You know, Daniel was, remember, he was the boy who had asked for a cookie. And so he was never the type to ever confront his father. And all of a sudden, there was a defiant confrontation. And that's my immediate reaction to that kind of confrontation is a slap across the face. And I mean, in other words, a rebellion, you hit immediately. And there I was, stretched out there, you know, trying to do that. And, you know, a volcano rose inside of me. And I don't mean, you know, mean or anything like that. It was, you know, it was a reaction against only a disciplined reaction against that type of thing. I loved him. I wasn't out of sorts. I wasn't in the flesh. I was in a very strong reaction feeling against rebellion. And immediately come right down again. I mean, you know, and move on into the service and so forth. I wasn't disturbed in my spirit, but I would not tolerate that. And Dad was always strong. And so Daniel, quieted right back down. He could not confront me. And boom, he was right back down. But you see, he was crying for help inside. And he was subtly finding out that one way he can get Dad's attention is to do something wrong and Dad would be right there. And I wasn't wise enough to know that, because, see, I never related to that kind of behavior. I mean, I never did things like that. I never thought that way. I never did understand that principle. I understand people do that, but it still baffles my mind. And so, you know, instead of doing something good to get it, you know. And anyway, I suppose one of the reasons there is we overlook the good, see, but we handle the bad. And that's part of the problem. We're not taking enough, we expect them to be good. And so, like, my dad asked me to do something one time. I said, we got older, you know, and I said, what do you give me if I do that? He said, well, it's not what I'm going to give you if you do, it's what I'm going to give you if you don't. I got the point, and I did it. And so anyway, one day down in our basement, lower area of the house, he made a statement that shocked me, that I would never believe that Daniel would ever make such a statement. Now, see, he didn't believe what he said. He didn't mean what he said. But it was the last desperate cry to Dad. It was a terrible statement, but I'm going to show it. This was not Daniel. It was a crying soul inside that didn't know what else to do, and he was hurt because Jesus was coming between him and his father. The church was coming between him and his father. And he said something, and I said, Daniel, you'll go to hell if you so. And he says, well, somebody's got to go to hell. And it shocked me to death. It shook me so bad that I began to talk to him. And I put my arms around him, and I hugged him, and he began to cry. Told him I loved him, and I began to cry. And we hugged each other and cried together, which was needed at that time. And he was all right. He was all right. He came on through that. But you see, fathers, you can't be too busy for your children. You have a responsibility for their souls. And children, let me talk to you teenagers. I'm going to talk to you high schoolers and junior high schoolers a moment particularly. Some of you have this problem. Would you, what I want you to do, let me tell you what to do, as hard as it is. Don't get in trouble in school in order to get attention. That's the wrong way. The teachers and parents have a hard time understanding that. Go to your father and say, Dad, I need to talk to you a moment. Dad, I'm in trouble. Dad, I'm in trouble because of you. I need you, Dad. I love you, Dad. I'm losing you, Dad. You're not giving me time, Dad. You used to take me out to play baseball. You don't do anything with me. I need you, Dad. Don't turn me off. Heal me. I'm getting in trouble at school. I'm finding myself getting something happening. A demon is entering me inside. I'm getting morose. I'm getting problems. I don't understand what's happening, Dad, but I need you. Help me, Dad. Help me. I need you. I'm crying out to you. Tell him. And then if he can't heal you, tell Mom. And then if she doesn't heal you, tell teacher. And if they don't heal, tell elder. But try to communicate, and rather than all of a sudden be a problem in school. We had a kid, like I mentioned, this little freckle-faced kid. I don't know who he is now. He should be up here around college age now. I don't know whatever happened to him. But this little kid, we were new in the church, and they just, everybody tipped me off. What's that kid? He's a problem kid. I mean, you know, he'll pull doors open, put stuff in. He's just going around hunting, you know, for a problem to occur. He was trying to make one, see? And I saw that kid, and my heart went out to him. And I reached out, I went by one day, and I said, next time I saw him, here come this kid running on the corner. And I grabbed him, and I said, hi, pal. Gave him a big smile and a hug. First time, probably, everybody was after that kid. Because inside, he was miserable, and so he was, you know, a runaway freight train. And so I hugged him and gave him a smile. Next time he passed me, when the chief of the place takes notice of the likes of him, this is a big deal. And I come down and, boy, he straightened up, big smile across his face. I said, hi and hi, Pastor. And next thing you know, can I get you water for you for the pulpit, you know? And then next thing you know, how do you get to be a pastor? Do you own this place? And that fast he was out of it. That kid had was no more problem. Somebody loved him, and the problem was over that fast. Parents, there's a lack of sensitivity to what's happening. And children, you need to communicate to your parents what's happening inside of you. You see, oh, they don't care. They'll just, well, you tell them. You tell them they don't care. You go to them and say, I need help, and I feel like you don't care, and I'm in trouble, and I need time. And then when they don't understand and say, well, what's your problem? I mean, what time do you want? This way. You say, Dad, I don't think you're understanding. Remember what Pastor talked about? That's me. I'm in trouble, Dad. You're going to lose me. I don't want to be lost. I don't want to like what's happening inside of me. I don't like to feel this way. I don't like to be a naughty kid. I don't like this reaction I got inside. I don't know how to handle it. Do something for me. Let's communicate. Parents, reach out to them. I guess I've been going on for some time. How to get started, I'm going to have to quit. Well, I thought that sharing some of these things, I had a lot more things, you know, in the bag, but it just takes a while to bring them. Maybe I'll bring some more sometime. But if it causes you, if I don't do any more, then just cause you to be more sensitive and to begin to we get the responsibility of interacting with your child and knowing what's happening and where they're at and having a love relationship with them. You know, having a good relationship with them is so important. It'll keep them steady during the times to come. God bless you. Stand.